Welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, in the studios of WMOT-FM. What happens when a person who is hired to cast a critical lens on the media finds himself in the media spotlight, and not for good reasons? That's one of the issues we're going to examine today with Dr. Larry Burris, who is a professor of journalism here at MTSU. We're also going to talk about national media coverage of the Boston Marathon tragedy and the fertilizer plant explosion in West Texas. We'll be back to explore all this with Larry after these words from MTSUnews.com.
Here are some of the stories now on MTSUnews.com, the university's news and information website. MTSU has been recognized for its community service efforts with inclusion on the 2013 President's Higher Education Community Service Honor Roll. The Honor Roll annually highlights the role colleges and universities throughout the nation play in solving community problems. A new agreement between MTSU and Columbia State Community College will help students majoring in early childhood education turn their associate degrees into bachelor's degrees at MTSU's Murfreesboro campus. The agreement will provide Columbia State students access to MTSU's Bachelor of Science degree program in early childhood education. And MTSU held the inaugural 1911 Society Luncheon recently to recognize those community members who've made financial commitments to the university for the long term. For MTSU News at any time, go to MTSUnews.com. That's MTSUnews.com.
Larry, thanks for being with us today.
Glad to be here. Glad to be here.
What was your take on the overall media coverage of the Boston Marathon bombings?
There's kind of some schizophrenic split personality kinds of things going on. When you have a major news story, it's hard to get all the facts right the very first time. So inevitably, there's going to be some errors. You try not to have those. I remember Martha Bryan, my first journalism instructor, and the cliche, be first, but first be right. And you need to get the news on, but then, of course, the facts need to be right. One of the mythologies, one of the urban legends, one of the problems is news media in general think they have to be absolutely first in order to beat the competition. Well, if I'm on CNN, for example, if I'm watching CNN, I don't know what's on Fox or MSNBC, so it doesn't matter if CNN is right on time, 5 seconds late, 10 seconds later, 2 or 3 minutes later. As the viewer, I'm not going to know that. So CNN can, in fact, take the time to get the facts right and not worry about being absolutely first. And I pick CNN just as an example. That works for newspapers, magazines, and any other broadcast network as well.
Then why do so many people, especially in the television industry, use this adrenaline-fueled rush to get it on the air first? If it doesn't matter with the viewer, if it doesn't matter for the image, if it doesn't matter for the ratings, if it doesn't matter for the money, why be first at all costs?
Because as a reporter, I want to be first. I want to get the story on first before everybody else, just as a matter of personal pride. And that's all well and good. That was very good when all we had was newspapers. And the newspaper's story might come out 12, 14, 24 hours after the event. But with the rush to broadcast news and immediacy, there's that pressure to be number one. And it's a good feeling to have the story on first, but at the same time, if you get the story on first and get it wrong, that's a big downer.
Now, John King found that out because of all the people who got things wrong during the course of this developing story. John King seems to have taken the biggest beating for it. He's a correspondent at CNN. He reported that an arrest had been made when, in fact, an arrest had not been made. But arrests eventually were made, and yet it turned out that he was premature at best.
Let's kind of take a worst-case scenario, a presidential assassination. You've got to get the news on, but how many sources do you check to say the president's been shot? And there have been examples after examples of reporters checking with every source available, and the sources had the information wrong. and there's no way to check the source of the sources. So at some point you have to say, we're going with the story. And in every case like that, you hope and pray you've got it right. Sometimes it's going to be wrong. Your sources and the sources of the sources will be wrong. There's a philosophical question. If I have a source and then I check the source's source, and I check the source of the source's source, how far back do we go on that? And the easy answer is, well, you check with the hospital. Find out if somebody's injured, wounded. You check with the police department to see if somebody's been arrested. And if the source of the source of the source says the person is injured or the person's been arrested, at some point you got to go with it. Now, sometimes the source may have real reasons for being wrong. So if I'm on the police desk and I think my captain has said this person's been arrested, I may say this person's been arrested. And in fact, they haven't. You know, as a source, I was relying on my source. That's not to apologize for the media getting it wrong. When the media, when reporters, and it's not the media that get it wrong, it's reporters that get it wrong. Okay. When reporters get it wrong, they've got to come on immediately and not just correct the story. Reporters need to say, we were wrong. We checked our sources. You may not need to name the sources, but you need to say, every one of our sources said this. We're sorry. We were wrong. And I think admitting the mistakes would go a long way towards adding credibility to the media.
Of course, not to be apologetic again, but in a worst-case scenario situation, take the Reagan assassination attempt in which Frank Reynolds of ABC News inaccurately at the anchor's desk told the audience that James Brady, the press secretary, had died when in fact he was not dead. And he became very upset at having had incorrect information conveyed to him from someone else, which he then conveyed to the national audience. That's a frenetic situation in which not only are reporters and people in the booth and the Secret Service and the police and the doctors, everybody who could be a source is rushing around like a bat out of hell, and that makes it more difficult to double and triple check sources.
Absolutely. And in the case of James Brady, the White House press office said that Mr. Brady was killed. The hospital said he was dead. The family said he was dead. How many other places can you check? And I can understand Frank Reynolds being upset. He's on the point. He's sitting there in front of the camera telling millions of people that this event has happened. And you know, he has to rely on his sources, who are relying on other sources. And at times, no matter how much you check, it could still be wrong.
And according to Katrina M. Mendelera of iVocus.com, John King was not alone in his error in the Boston Marathon bombing reportage. The Wall Street Journal made a boo-boo. The New York Post made a boo-boo. The New York Daily News, the Associated Press. You expect all of these major media outlets to be totally on top of their game. These are some of the best-known, best-funded media sources in the entire country.
They have to get it right, absolutely. And the more, I don't want to say the more important, the larger you are, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, ABC, CNN, it's more incumbent upon you, of course, to get the story right. And occasionally it's going to be wrong, and that's the time when the broadcaster has to say, we got it wrong. We hear a lot about immediacy, and it's going to be on the web right now, and it's going to be on television right now. The good thing about newspapers and magazines is you've got a lot more time to check the story and get it out. Once again, it comes back to trying to be first.
We'll have more with Larry Burris about media coverage on MTSU on the Record right after this.
A utility is cleaning up a drilling slurry spill at a state natural area where it's laying a gas pipeline in Nashville. Piedmont Natural Gas spokesman David Trusty tells the Tennessean that the company regrets the spill and is working with state environmental officials to remove about 300 gallons of a clay mixture from Otter Creek in the Radnor Lake Natural Area. Radnor advocate Clark Tidwell, a longtime Nashville attorney, says the mishap is what environmentalists feared when Piedmont got permission to cross the preserve. An incident report from Piedmont stated the hydraulic pressure of boring was too great for soft soil conditions to withstand.
We're talking about media coverage of breaking news events with Dr. Larry Burris, who is a journalism professor here at MTSU. At around the same time as the media were providing extensive developing news coverage of the Boston Marathon bombings and their aftermath, a fertilizer plant blew up in West Texas. More people were killed in the fertilizer plant explosion, and more people were injured in the fertilizer plant explosion than in the Boston Marathon bombings. But the Boston Marathon bombings caught the lion's share of attention, although, you know, to their credit, the 24/7 news networks did break in and did attempt to use as much of their resources as they could to get boots on the ground down to this small town. Tell us what kind of decisions that assignment editors and producers have to make when they have two cataclysmic events like this, violent events, events that cost people their lives, happening in different parts of the country at the same time.
Rightly or wrongly, you have to go with where the equipment is. There was equipment in Boston. You're talking major metropolitan area. The equipment for the marathon was there. West Texas is a long way from a major media market, and the events in Boston were a lot more certain. You knew right away there was an explosion, people were killed, and people were injured. In West Texas, the first news was there was an explosion, and the response at first is there was an explosion, okay, and you sort of stop there and wait for the rest of the news to come in. You try to send reporters there as quickly as you can. And the major cable networks, in fact, use a lot of stringers. So there were stations from Texas were there on the scene as quickly as possible. But because of the nature of the explosion, nobody really knew what was going on for a fairly long time in the news cycle. And television, again, is a visual medium. It's an action medium. And in Texas, the first story was a reporter standing in front of a fire a long way away saying there was an explosion. Right. Where do we go from here?
You could see it from behind the Sonic drive-in.
Sure, absolutely.
I remember that picture.
You don't know the cause. You don't know how many were injured. You don't know how many people were killed. And to put a reporter there and just to say, there was an explosion, and then stop, where do you go with that? Well, eventually news came that this was a far larger tragedy in terms of death than in Boston. Again, though, what we have to perhaps balance out is Boston was an act of terrorism, and the explosion in Texas was an industrial accident. And again, rightly or wrongly, terrorism stories are going to generate more news than an industrial explosion. That's how it is.
It was easier to get people for the West Texas story on the telephone. What did you see? What did you hear? That kind of thing. Plus, I think reporters and editors justifiably assumed that there was a greater possibility of the fertilizer plant explosion being an accident because fertilizer is an ingredient used in homemade bombs.
Correct.
And can be volatile under certain circumstances. And the possibility of a terrorist wanting or needing to blow up a fertilizer plant in a remote section of Texas just, you know, didn't make logical sense.
Sure, sure. And again, with the Boston Marathon, we knew very quickly what the facts of the story were. The facts in West Texas, we're still not sure what caused the explosion. So again, you go, in this case, you go with where the facts are, and the facts were in Boston. On the one hand, I've got a terrorist act, an explosion in the middle of downtown Boston, and I've got an industrial explosion. When I don't know immediately how many people were injured, we didn't know right away the extent of the damage. We try to find out, but you've got to get as much on as you can, as quickly as you can, and you start have to check out the facts. And it took a lot longer to get some solid facts out of West Texas than it did out of Boston.
In the case of both tragedies, but when it comes to still photographs and video, how do reporters and editors make decisions about how graphic their images are going to be, because we are talking about, in the case of the Marathon bombings, limbs being blown off, a great many people having to undergo amputations. We're talking about blood and devastation in both cases. What kind of a mental process does a journalist go through in determining what's too gory, or if it's so truthfully gory and authentic that it has to be shown this way in order to get the truth across?
That depends who you are. If you're the photographer or the editor, I don't want to pass the buck back to the editors, but I remember my photojournalism instructor setting up a scenario. He said, you're on a beach, and 100 yards out in the water, you see somebody drowning. You don't swim. There's no pole. There's no boat. What do? Take a picture. You give it to the editor. And you have to consider your audience out there. And I think you need to err on the side of caution. You need to say, okay, is the graphicness of this really adding anything to the story besides a picture of an arm laying in the middle of the street? I don't know that that's really adding anything to the story. The story is the humanness, is the person, and I don't want to show what's left of their arm, for example. I don't want to show a lot of blood and gore, but I need to show something that indicates the extent of this tragedy. And maybe it's just a photo, an overall scene. I would be tempted to leave the bloodstains in. I would be less likely to show the actual injury.
The bloodstains on the sidewalk.
On the sidewalk, yes. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'd be less likely to show the actual injury.
Would you think twice before showing pictures of people hysterically crying or in emotional agony? Or is that part and parcel of your coverage?
The emotional agony is part and parcel. Unfortunately, that goes back to the old days, 15, 20 years ago, when we had the grieving widow and asked, how do you feel?
Sob stories.
I think we've gotten away from those for the most part. So again, the crying, the yelling, the grieving, I don't really know that adds a whole lot to the story either. So I would tend not to. Because there's still a perception that all we do is grieving widows. The public still thinks that. So I would tend to stay away from that story. That would just reinforce what is a wrong stereotype about showing the grieving widow.
There are really graphic photos from back in the day. But, for example, graphic photos of the Holocaust victims' naked bodies being shoved into a mass grave were taken because the scope and scale of this horror is so incredible that the photographer practically has to do that in order to convince people that the Holocaust actually mm-hmm. happened.
Sure.
Same thing with the hangings of Mussolini and his mistress. Is Mussolini really dead? Well, you have to prove it. Here's the picture. In this case, media coverage is so extensive and omnipresent that you don't really have to feel compelled to prove to the American people that this really did happen by going into gory depth.
Mm-hmm. Even in the case of Holocaust pictures, there's really not a whole lot in terms of gore that you're seeing. You're seeing dead bodies, and that's certainly a tragedy. But there's not a whole lot that I've seen a close-up of faces, of injuries. You see a general scene. That's a lot different than showing the wound itself, than showing spurting blood. Mm-hmm. We've seen the hanging photographs from Mussolini. And again, there's really not a whole lot there. The pictures themselves are almost sanitized, because you're really not seeing a whole lot. I think a video of somebody being hung, a close-up, I would certainly never show that. I'd be tempted to show the end result, certainly. But in terms of the actual action, and we've seen execution photographs where we've stopped at the point of impact. We've seen a video of beheadings. And again, we sort of stop there before the actual event takes place.
I think the most recent example I can think of was when a Florida newspaper tried to get a hold of the late NASCAR racer Dale Earnhardt's autopsy photos, which I thought was utterly gratuitous.
That would add nothing. The person, be it Dale Earnhardt, being somebody else, what do those photographs really add to the news story? Not much. The people who need to see the photographs have seen the photographs. Now, at the same time, because of the internet, You may be tempted to put the pictures out there. They're for people to see. I can't imagine wanting to see one, but there are curious people out there. And we've seen on cable television shows extensive blood and gore. You look at the forensic programs, for example, CSI and Bones and NCIS. You've seen some pretty graphic stuff in those images, and I don't know if we've become immune to those sorts of things or not.
We'll have more on MTSU On the Record. When we come back, we'll talk about Howard Kurtz's fall from grace. Stay with us.
The Army ROTC College Program at MTSU prepares students mentally, physically, and emotionally to become leaders and promotes virtues of duty, honor, country. ROTC cadets are involved in all academic disciplines, athletics, and student organizations at MTSU. Full scholarships and tuition assistance are awarded based on merit. All cadets upon graduation will serve their country as second lieutenants either in the Army, Army Reserve, or Army National Guard. For all the latest MTSU news and information, go to mtsunews.com.
We're talking about the media with Dr. Larry Burris, professor of journalism here at MTSU. The host of CNN's Reliable Sources, Howard Kurtz, who also used to be a media critic for the Washington Post, has been taken to task for claiming that Jason Collins, the NBA player who came out as gay, did not reveal that he was once engaged to a woman. He came out in Sports Illustrated. It was a cover story, big news, because he was touted as the first major professional athlete to voluntarily come out as gay. Howard Kurtz lost his job at the online site The Daily Beast over it, although it had been said that there was a parting of the ways in the works for quite some time. And Kurtz, on his own program, underwent a grilling by two media critic reporters over his sloppiness, his inaccuracies, and whether or not he was trying to do too much at one time. Is this a case of a media pundit, if you will, having too much on his plate, trying to do too many things, serve too many masters, or was it just plain old inexcusable inaccuracy?
It was plain old inaccuracy. He got the story wrong. He had plenty of time to check. He did not need to get the story on right now. Could have spent some time checking. Didn't do that for whatever reason. Again, as we were talking before, how many sources does he have to check? He had the documents in front of him, and he just flat got it wrong. That shows some irresponsibility. That shows some sloppy reporting. And when you get to that level, the mistakes are multiplied, and you suffer the consequences. If you're going to be at the top, it's a long way down to the bottom. And if you're the king, if you're number one, you've got to make sure you get it right every time. That's the problem with being up there, and your mistakes are magnified, and you take the consequences.
If you're a media critic, by definition, do you have to be held to a higher standard than other reporters?
Absolutely. If you're going to be criticizing the media, then you've got to do the things that you're, how do I put this now? You have to do the things correctly that you criticize the other media people for doing incorrectly. You have to get the story right. And it may be a real honest mistake, but you made a major error. And I don't know if he was fired because he made the major error or just didn't do the reporting necessary. There's two different issues there.
Did you watch the questioning of Kurtz on Reliable
Yes.
Sources with David Folkenflik of NPR and Dylan Byers of Politico?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
What did you think of it? Were they fair?
I think that they were fair. Again, when you're at the top, you have to subject yourself to that kind of criticism. He apologized on air. He faced the camera. He talked directly to the audience and said, "I'm sorry, I made a mistake, and we're sorry too." But this sort of practice, again, if he was under deadline pressure, then he shouldn't have put himself under that kind of pressure. The story was not hot news that had to be on right away. If he was sloppy in his reporting, we fired reporters for a lot less than that.
Do you think Kurtz apologized adequately? Do you think his mea culpa was adequate?
I think so. He explained what happened. The mistake seems reasonable. He felt that he was under pressure. He had to get the story out right now. That's what reporters do. We get them out as soon as we can, but we have to check and make sure all the stories are right. How many checks do you make? Well, he obviously didn't make enough and suffer the consequences. Again, when you get to that level, the mistakes are flat inexcusable. There's no excuse for that. We understand, I think we in the media understand how he did it. We may be sorry for him, but when you get to that level, you can't make those sorts of mistakes.
Should CNN have fired him?
I don't know. Again, it was a rookie mistake. Now, unfortunately, Howard Kurtz has a history of making those kinds of mistakes, and eventually it's going to catch up. They probably should have, yes.
Mm-hmm. We'll round up this edition of MTSU on the Record after this brief pause.
MTSU's Jewish and Holocaust Studies minor offers undergraduate students a chance to study the culture and religion of the Jewish people and the Holocaust in an interdisciplinary program. Studies include history and culture, theology and philosophy, and the arts and social sciences. Courses tackle vital topics central to local and global awareness, including multiculturalism and the meanings of diversity, religious tolerance, and genocide. For the latest MTSU news and information, go to mtsunews.com.
In our concluding moments with Dr. Larry Burris, there is an article written by Michael Wolff in The Guardian, which is a British newspaper, that said, Howard Kurtz isn't the problem at the Daily Beast, which is the website that fired him. It's Tina Brown. He's not really taking up for Kurtz totally, but he takes Brown to task for what he calls her famously mercurial and attention deficit management style, quote unquote, and trying to hire a lot of big names to draw attention to the website instead of hiring accomplished journalists whose names people don't know. Is that fair?
I think so. The news, Howard Kurtz probably doesn't do a lot of individual reporting. He probably does not go out and pound the pavement anymore. He's paid his dues. He worked his way up. He has a staff working for him. Tina Brown needs to make sure that she is hiring journalists, that she is hiring people who know how to investigate, who have the sources, who know how to write, who know how to check. But again, even if you hire all of those people, there's still a chance of getting it wrong. But you need to have a good staff down there that's giving correct information to your anchor. When the anchor, Howard Kurtz, when he starts doing it on his own, he most of the time gets it right. He really does. But at that level, there's no such thing as a small mistake at that level. Getting somebody's past history wrong when the facts are right in front of you is just inexcusable. The public in general doesn't know how the news media work. There are some general thoughts, but I think the terms of day-to-day, what we do, most of the public doesn't know that, and we need to do a better job explaining it and explaining how the mistakes come about.
It ain't exactly Lou Grant, right?
No, it's not exactly Lou Grant. Absolutely not.
Dr. Burris, thanks for being with
us
today.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
MTSU On the Record, a news and information program about Middle Tennessee State University, is produced by the university's Marketing and Communications Office, which is solely responsible for its content. Read more about MTSU at our website, mtsunews.com. Podcasts of this program are available at mtsunews.com and on iTunes.